She's one of the most sought-after political analysts in Florida and the nation, and she has a new book out, Florida's Minority Trailblazers, the men and women who changed the face of Florida government. Our Florida Matters newsmaker is Dr. Susan McManus.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper. Dr. McManus is a distinguished professor of public administration and political science at the University of South Florida. Her latest book is called Florida's Minority Trailblazers. Welcome. Great to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to dig into the book in just a moment, but before that, do you mind if we dig into you a little bit?
I'm just a country girl from Pasco County.
You are our newsmaker after all. So you did. You grew up in Florida, went to FSU, attended University of Michigan, then came back to FSU for your PhD. You were in Texas for a while, too.
Right. My first university job was at the University of Houston for around 9 years, and then I went to Cleveland State University. But I was always trying to get back home because I was born in Tampa. My family lives here for
and
the family.
And all your studies all involve politics, public
Absolutely.
Service, right?
Absolutely.
So what got you into politics and public service in the first place?
I grew up in a very news-conscious family. We talked about the news every day at the dinner table. I watched my parents read newspapers avidly. Very divided family politically.
So you did not live in or grow up in an echo chamber?
No.
So it was divided how? What, your mom and dad right. against each other
right.
politically?
And uncles and aunts against each other. Even now when we have family gatherings, we can banter about politics very seriously and then put it aside and start.
Boy, those were the days, you know, when you could actually be divided in a household and not be calling the lawyer for a divorce or something like that. Not like today. It seems like
you know, it made me a better teacher because my classes at USF are really divided from a partisan perspective. And I teach my students to be respectful of other people's opinions, especially when they're in college. Take the time to find out why somebody thinks differently from you. It will help you the rest of your life.
Now, you said you don't like partisanship in the classroom or you encourage it.
I encourage it, but with respect. Obviously, you can't teach politics without understanding that there are these parties and that they do often disagree on policy, for sure.
The Washington Post reported back in February that on the rise of liberal activism and intolerance on college campuses, and I know you've seen these stories from around. Are you not seeing that personally, not happening in Florida? Or
I see it happening all over the place. It's very distressful to me, and even more distressful is the fact that we're seeing freedom of speech trampled on to the point of where I can't even believe what I'm seeing.
Was there a time when you considered getting into politics? Why aren't you holding an office somewhere?
It's the number one question people have asked me over the years. My favorite story there was an older gentleman years back, one of my very first speeches to a group like the Kiwanis or whatever, and I took questions at the end, and he says, "Can I ask you something?" And I said, "Sure." He says, "What's a nice young lady like you doing in politics?"
Oh, my.
I was happy he called me a lady, but I had entertained the thought of it until I came face-to-face with some friends that were running against each other. This was in my Texas days, and it was the early women's movement, and two of my friends were running against each other and turned on each other, and I thought, you know, I'm a country girl. Loyalty and friendship means a lot to me, so I really put that aside, and actually now I'm much more pleased to be in a position of doing really great policy work, polls and surveys that are used by all the legislators and all decision makers instead of just me being one of many. My research is used by many, and that makes me much more satisfied, I think.
Did you have a high opinion of polling after the presidential election last year?
I knew it was coming, and it was kind of bad. I, of course, wasn't surprised by it. We were seeing it here in Florida because my students are required to work in campaigns, and they were telling me every week, my Republican students who were going door to door, there were a lot of people that weren't being truthful about the fact that they were going to vote for Trump. So we knew it was there.
Florida Southern College just released a survey that shows many Floridians don't have a clue when it comes to how government works. Only 65% could name Rick Scott as governor. Only around 35% knew who Paul Ryan was, and just over half could explain why some states have more members in the U.S. House than others. Only about half knew that the first 10 amendments of the Constitution were known as the Bill of Rights. You've got to be a little concerned about that.
I see it all the time, and it very much angers me that we don't emphasize civics and history more. In K through 12, we've watered it down the curriculum quite a bit, and so students are very unfamiliar with their government. I get people in my upper-level classes here at USF, bright students that just have really not had a very great background and detailed background about government. And, of course, now you add to that a lot of people who just are simply not news junkies. They're not even going to listen to the news. They get their news from unusual places. And they really know almost nothing about the structure of government and how things get done. Especially, it's bad at the local level.
Where should we be getting our news?
Multiple places. The more, the better.
Yeah. What about you?
I get it from, I read at least 10 or 15 papers a day. And listen to every cable when I'm on the road and try to switch between the evening broadcast news and...
All right, Florida's Minority Trailblazers, it's an incredible book. Why did you write it?
Moving back to Florida and starting to teach Florida politics and knowing the history of the state, there just weren't a lot of good materials that showed the racial and ethnic diversification of our state. And it wasn't being written by political scientists, and some of it was being written by historians, but only in a very narrow way.
Mm-hmm.
I got an idea for this project as a consequence of several of my students were doing honors theses under me and looking for subjects, and about the time that I was really searching for these kinds of materials. And that prompted me to begin the project. It took 10 years to complete. A lot of research had to be done. And we started with the civil rights movement, but particularly the moment in Florida when one person, one vote was the organizing principle for elections. So we had, yes, some minorities elected before we went to one person, one vote, single member districts. But we really started with the 60s, and I ended right before the 2016 election. So 50 years of looking at trailblazers, people who were an intersection of their race and ethnicity and gender and party. So I didn't want to just focus on one race or one political party, and I didn't want to just focus on one branch of government. So it includes the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branches, and we also looked at congressional members who made history.
What did someone have to do to earn the name Trailblazer? Was being a minority enough, or did they have to have some sort of achievement, for instance, a legislative achievement in their career?
You had to be the first elected or appointed member of your race, gender, and ethnicity. So, for example, Annie Betancourt was the first Cuban female Democrat elected to the Florida House of Representatives. That would be how it would go.
Mm-hmm. And you interviewed many of the people that you profile.
I interviewed most of them. The ones that I didn't were deceased, and the rest of them I tried to get. And that's what took a long while for some trailblazers who are very busy setting aside a time for me to come and interview them in person, and the interviews usually lasted around an hour to an hour and a half, required a lot of coordinating of people's busy schedules.
Mm-hmm.
And as the project kept getting delayed with an election coming along, I had to put the work aside and focus on being an analyst and then go back to the project. So with every election came some new trailblazers.
Yeah.
And so the project just kept proliferating and expanding. But I had a lot of student help. In the book, I've identified all 10 of the students who worked very closely with me on the book.
What sort of questions did you ask these trailblazers?
We gave them a list of, we meaning myself and the students who work with me, gave them a list of questions. All of them got the same questions. They didn't all choose to emphasize the same things. But what got you into politics? What were some of the biggest barriers that you had to deal with? Who were people who helped you along the way? Were there any particular issues that prompted you to run? Was there some kind of structural change? Was it, you know, an open seat, or was it redistricting? And who prompted you to run?
Mm-hmm.
How did you campaign? What advice would you give to a young person of your background who wanted to enter politics today? So around 10 questions that we gave to each of the trailblazers. They had the questions before I interviewed them.
I didn't count them, but how many trailblazers are there profiled in your book?
Over 50.
Did any common themes emerge from that line of questioning?
One biographical commonality which struck me being an educator was that every single one of these trailblazers had a college education and most of them an advanced degree. Many of them were educators. Many of them started in local politics. Many of them belonged to very important networks within their race or gender. And many of them were just very supportive of younger people getting into politics. And I would say almost all of them that were in the election category. Obviously, the Supreme Court justices are appointed, not elected, other than retention. But most of the elected ones were looking back and saying that they really don't like the change in politics, how they campaign. And today they really almost universally do not like outside groups running ads and infiltrating the whole election campaign.
I also got a sense from having read the book that the common denominator was also that they all felt like there was a sense of, there was a mission, you know, to right a wrong, particularly because they could relate to it on a personal level.
Right. Writing a wrong or just trying to get people like them in office to be a trailblazer for those who came behind them. A lot of the women expressed that particular notion, but a lot of the women were also very incensed about the treatment of women up to that point because a lot of the early ones were there in the women's movement. Many of the trailblazing women were educators and saw that there just wasn't a lot of female presence in legislative bodies or executive or judicial.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about some of the many trailblazers in just a moment. I don't think we're going to get to all 50, but we'll do our best. Our Florida Matters newsmaker is USF political science professor Dr. Susan McManus. Her latest book is called Florida's Minority Trailblazers, published by University Press of Florida. You can find a link to it on our website. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. USF political science professor Susan McManus is our Florida Matters newsmaker. Her new book is called Florida's Minority Trailblazers, The Men and Women Who Changed the Face of Florida Government. Your book includes state lawmakers, as you pointed out earlier, members of Congress, judges, justices, and at least one chairperson of the Seminole Indian tribe, Betty May Tiger Jumper.
Yes, she was the first woman chair of any Native American tribe in the entire United States. And she was the product of a biracial marriage. Her mother was pure Seminole, mm-hmm. and her father was an Anglo, a Frenchman. And he split from the family, and early on, there was a rule in the tribe that if you were the child of such a marriage or relationship, that you were to be killed as a child. And she and her brother were afraid that someone was going to come to their door, and someone was actually coming to their door to...
Really?
The blessing was that an uncle intervened and said no. So she left the state and went to school in North Carolina, the Cherokee tribe up there, came back to Florida, created a health clinic, created schools, everything. She was one of the first to sign the charter that created the Seminole tribe. Fascinating history that so few people know about.
She was elected in 1967. Florida's two main tribes are the Seminoles and the Miccosukees. They're not really, you couldn't call them a politically cohesive group. They're pretty much all over the map. And they're sort of overlooked in a way. Are there or have there ever been any Native Americans elected to statewide office in Florida?
Not yet. But what is happening is they're extremely active in the world of politics. Obviously, gambling is a big issue for the tribe. It's made them big contributors to political campaigns. And now we also see that a number of the Seminole and Miccosukee children are going to college. So it's a matter of time, really, before they run.
I mentioned Eliana Ross Leighton because she was just in the news, of course, announcing her retirement after 28 years as the most senior member of Congress from Florida.
Right. Eliana Ross started her political career in the Florida House. But a little bit of her background is very important to understand why she ended up in Congress. She was a child when she came from Cuba. Her parents left under the duress of the dictatorship there, thought they were only staying a brief moment, ended up staying a long time. She couldn't speak a word of English when she came here, ended up watching television, American television. Many of the Hispanic trailblazers said that's how they learned English, was watching American television.
Right.
But ultimately, from the get-go, was all about education and about freedom. She actually has a PhD in education from the University of Miami, but when she was first out of school, created a little school to teach people English. And obviously, she ran for the House, a redistricting thing. Her whole family was her campaign team. Her dad was her campaign manager. Her mother was her campaign volunteer coordinator. Ran on a shoestring, won, hit the House. And probably one of the more interesting things is she got married while she was in the legislature. So some people say there's good that comes out of the legislature.
That's right. She was Eliana Ross,
right,
and then Dexter Layton. And
right.
They
and he
married.
Ended up changing. She changed his political party.
Right.
Then she ran for an open seat in the Congress when Claude Pepper passed. Very, very competitive race.
Yeah.
Ended up winning and was called by Katie Couric from the Today Show to inform her the morning after the election that she was the first Hispanic woman elected to the Congress. And she says, oh, no, you must be mistaken. And Katie says, no, we have a pretty good research team. Trust me, you're the first.
All right. She also made news recently as one of the few Republicans in Congress to vote against the repeal and replace Obamacare bill.
That right. She's always been a fairly moderate Republican when it comes to social and moral issues, very much a hawk when it comes to foreign policy, particularly as it relates to Cuba. But many don't realize that one of the reasons for her longtime support of the LGBTQ community is that her son is a transgender.
Mm-hmm. The first man of Chinese ancestry to be elected to the Florida House was Democrat Edmund J. Gong. Asians are also very underrepresented in state politics.
He was only one. There's a female, Mimi McAndrews, who was elected to the House. But Eddie, as they called him, Eddie Gong, a fascinating gentleman who took me through the history of his family, beginning with the dynasties way back, and he's of Chinese descent.
He has a great story. Yeah.
All the way to the present, and it was so moving, and talked about how his family opened up a little grocery store when laundry business wasn't doing well in the African-American part of Miami, when no one else would go in there to open up little corner stores, and that's how the family did well. But my most precious memory from this was I was not even home from Miami from the interview when I got a call from his wife, who used to be a reporter for the Miami Herald, who said, you know, if you wouldn't mind me being so bold and presumptuous, would you mind giving us a tape of your interview with Eddie? And I said, well, sure. She says, I just want you to know that he shared things about his family history that his own children don't know.
Wow.
And I can't tell you how much that, how good that made me feel that I could help somebody. And that's one of the purposes of the book, is to share these kinds of stories with generations to come and people who are really interested in how Florida evolved to be one of the most diverse states in the entire country.
Yeah, he had a great story. Parents from China, came to America back in the 20s, worked hard, opened up those markets, as you pointed out, in areas where white grocers did not dare go, was very successful. And that background kind of teed him up to enter politics.
It did. Plus, he had also gone to a high school that was very diverse. And he was, I think, student body president. He went to Boys State, just got into politics at an early age. But his ability to connect and build coalitions across racial grounds was a really instrumental part of him being successful in Tallahassee.
He came up with Lawton Chiles in the 1960s.
And spoke very, very, very highly and passionately about the governor.
Yeah. I would also say he might be a little ahead of his time back then. One of his legislative achievements was anti-gerrymandering, Fair Districts 1.0, I guess you could say. And he also pushed for land preservation in South Florida.
Right. And, of course, he was in the House and the Senate, so he was a trailblazer in two different chambers of the Florida legislature.
Someone we don't hear a whole lot about. In 1978, Governor Reuben Askew appointed Jesse J. McCrary, Jr. as Secretary of State. thus the first black member of the Florida cabinet, and later the first black lawyer from Florida to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. And the third thing, he was the first black member of the Florida Supreme Court. So he had a lot going on.
Absolutely did. And many of the trailblazers from the area that he's from talk about how inspirational he was in terms of particularly people in the law, that he had a law degree and was always thinking about injustices and the fact that he could make history arguing these very famous cases was a very big motivation for others.
He considered himself a link between the ghetto and the establishment, I think were his words. And I love this. He grew up in Marion County and was going to be a doctor until he realized he could not stand the sight of blood.
Right. Coming from a family where my siblings are doctors, I perfectly understand that. But definitely an inspiration to so many. And it is interesting in doing this book that most of the, when you look at the cabinet, minority members of the cabinet, all of them have been appointed. Doug Jamerson from Pinellas County was a cabinet member, commissioner of education, but when he ran for office, he got defeated. But he was appointed initially, and that was a pathway to the cabinet for the minority members, was an appointment by a governor.
And when you think of Jesse McCrary, he was admitted to the Florida Bar back in 1966, which was an incredibly tumultuous time in the civil rights era. What a time to be a black lawyer in Florida.
Absolutely. And you hear similar stories among the other blacks that have been trailblazers, first black chief justice of the Supreme Court and so forth. And the same for Peggy Quince, who was the first female black chief justice, that they talked about how early watching of what was going on around them in their own community, let alone really studying the news from the beginning, was what attracted them into the law. And it was injustice that was the compelling draw for them to get into the judiciary.
So I have a question, Dr. McManus. Has any of Florida's minority trailblazers come as close to the White House as Marco Rubio?
No.
He's the one.
He's the one.
I recall Rubio was a guest here on Florida Matters. It had to be, what, 10, 11 years ago, just as he was coming on board as Florida House Speaker. You were on our panel. I don't know if you remember or not. And I remember how impressed you were with Marco Rubio. He was just a politician on a book tour, you know, but you seemed to see something in Marco Rubio. Do you still see it?
I do, and he's not. If you watch what he's doing right now, he's not in lockstep with party. He's somewhat of an individualistic individual. He's an excellent debater. Everyone will agree that that's what launched him into the U.S. Senate position. But he's a trailblazer here because he was the first Hispanic Speaker of the House. And it is interesting that we've only had two minority heads of our legislative chambers, and both of them are Hispanic. So, and one was from Tampa. The first president, minority president of the Senate, was Louis Delaporte from Tampa. The first minority speaker, Hispanic, Marco Rubio.
And Delaporte, if I recall, was his family was from the Iberian Peninsula of Spain. I mean, that's where he was from, not Latin America.
Right. And we did really track country of origin. That's why the book is so expansive, because especially within the Hispanic community, you have trailblazers who are Colombian background, Nicaraguan background, Cuban background, Puerto Rican background. And among blacks, the same. You have those from other countries like Haiti, particularly Jamaica. So you have diversity, and we followed that because trailblazers that represented those different countries of origin really fit into the major theme of the book, which is the tremendous racial and ethnic diversity that we have in Florida. And that's because we have been a magnet for immigrants for decades.
I think most of us are pretty familiar with the Marco Rubio story, you know, thanks to the $165 million he spent on the presidential campaign. Born in Miami to Cuban migrants, first Hispanic Speaker of the House back in 2006, as you pointed out. Do you think he's still blazing trails?
I do, and I still think that he is not finished politically. But let's go back to his speakership, because right before him, another Hispanic had come close and didn't make it. And Marco Rubio acknowledged that in my interview with him. He pointed out that it was probably time, by the time that he decided to go for speaker, that people were thinking, we haven't had somebody from South Florida, we haven't had a Hispanic. And he never, ever strays from his heritage. And I think a lot of Americans, regardless of your background, respect that. I'm the granddaughter of an immigrant. And in that way, when he gave his acceptance speech to become speaker, it was so powerful within the Cuban community that it was even carried on Radio Martí.
Mm. There were several waves of Cubans arriving in the U.S. Back in the late 1800s, many arrived in Key West and in Tampa, attracted by the cigar industry. Many of their descendants came to hate Batista in the pre-Castro days. They saw Castro, at first at least, as a reformer who got rid of all the corruption thanks to Batista. And then, of course, there are those fleeing Castro, like the Rubios. So you really have two loose political blocks there among Cubans, the younger and more Republican and the older and somewhat more Democratic.
But even that's changed now. We have to talk about general replacement because today's Cuban voters are older and they're very much Republican. It's one of the reasons that Donald Trump ended up winning Florida narrowly as the older Cubans came out at a higher rate. But the younger Cubans now, just like younger blacks, younger Asians, younger people in general, are leaning more towards no party affiliation. And if they do vote, they do in some ways lean more Democratic than their elders, but they're a little bit more independent. And this is one of the fascinating things about always being interested in demographic research is I learned early on you must look at generational replacement to really understand today's politics. But certainly in history, it was a different scenario. As you said, the early Hispanics were Democrats. And you have a couple like Elvin Martinez from this area was a Democrat. He's a trailblazer in the book as well.
So what do these trailblazers teach us about things like taking risks, bucking the trends?
They absolutely show their stories are uniform in talking about other people encouraging them to run and being supportive and reaching a point at which there's nobody else to do it but me.
The book is called Florida's Minority Trailblazers, The Men and Women Who Changed the Face of Florida Government. Our Florida Matters newsmaker, Dr. Susan McManus, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Florida's Minority Trailblazers is published by University Press of Florida. You can find a link to it and more about Dr. McManus on our website. Florida Matters is produced by Stephanie Colombini, our engineer, Richard Jimenez. Our show is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.